Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Smarty Pants, the podcast of the American Scholar magazine, sponsored by Phi Beta Kappa. I'm your host, Stephanie Bastek. Whether it's Lemurians making their home on Mount Shasta, aliens alighting in the middle of Illinois, meat falling from the Kentucky sky, or cows being drained of blood in Oregon, accounts of unexplained phenomena are on the rise. But why have so many Americans opened themselves up to fringe beliefs and conspiracy theories when our empirical understanding of the world has increased? Cultural historian Colin Dickey joins us on the show this week to talk about his new book, Unidentified, in which he traverses the country in search of the cryptids and conspiracy theories that have stuck with us for the past few centuries, evolving alongside the dramatic changes in our frontiers, scientific knowledge, and cultural mores. Thank you so much for joining us, Colin.
Cool. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So your last book, Ghostland, explored America's haunted places, which are susceptible to a slightly different form of unidentified phenomenon. So what's different for you about the unexplained stories and mysteries and conspiracy theories that you're exploring in The Unidentified?
I mean, with Ghostland, I was going around to haunted places, to, haunted cities, haunted houses and hotels and things like that, looking for ghost stories and sort of what those ghost stories said about American history, about place, about, you know, these buildings. And with this book, when I started zeroing in on UFOs and aliens in places like Area 51 out in the middle of the desert, or with cryptids, which is the catch-all for things like Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster and the Chupacabra. These things also tended to be in sort of wilderness areas, be it, you know, the forests of Northern California or the Himalayas or, wherever. And what occurred to me is the locus of this book, you could say, is the kind of frontier or the wilderness at the edge of civilization. That seems to be both where these creatures tend to, you know, exist. They, you know, it's sort of right on the edge. It's not in the middle of the desert. It's the desert just outside of Las Vegas. You know, it's the Pine Barrens of New Jersey. It's places that are sort of on the edge of civilization, but right over the line. And so that seemed to be kind of where this book was situated in a way that felt a little different from Ghostland.
That's a really interesting way to connect things that seem really quite disparate. You know, not all conspiracy theories involve UFOs, and not all cryptids came from outer space, and, you know, meat falling from the sky, who knows what that has to do with. But there are a lot of characteristics shared by the Lemurians and the Altamahaha and cattle mutilation. So what do you think connects all of these different stories within American culture?
You know, when I went back and I started to try and unpack the history, one of the things that came to mind, or, you know, one of the things that came across in my research was this idea that, the kind of beginning of all this, you could probably say, is this guy, Ignatius Donnelly, who writes this book on Atlantis in the 1870s, which is the first real book. I mean, Plato talks about Atlantis, but he talks about it sort of in a kind of philosophical figure speech kind of way, like he's just sort of imagining a utopia. But Ignatius Donnelly comes along and writes this book where he's like, this is a real place. It has an archaeology, it has an anthropology, we can talk about it as like a real real location. And what occurs to me is that is really around the time when the map has gotten filled in. So if you think of sort of earlier medieval conceptions of the world. You had, you know, kind of the known world, and then you had the kind of fringes where you would, you know, put little monsters on the map and say, here there be dragons, basically like the places that we don't know about. And those places are by and large gone by the end of the 19th century. And almost as soon as they are, you have people like Ignatius Donnelly coming along and saying, you know, let's imagine, although he doesn't say let's imagine, he says this place is real. You know, there is a real place, but it exists outside of the filled in map. Basically, this immediate yearning for a place that is still untouched by civilization, you know, still doesn't, you know, it doesn't have a McDonald's or a railway station or something. And so what really connects a lot of these things, at least for me, and as I was sort of trying to trace the evolution of these various things, what seemed to really connect them all was this desire for that place that was just outside the reach of civilization. And they all seem to come about right around the time that civilization had kind of filled in the entire globe, for better or for worse.
You write in the introduction to the book how wildly popular a lot of these conspiracy theories and cryptid stories still are today, and in fact how interest in them has grown, which anecdotally you can see in Ancient Aliens on the History Channel and similar shows. And yet we have even fewer unknown territories today, fewer frontiers than we did in 1900. So why do you think there's a resurgence of interest in these unexplained, unidentified phenomena?
I mean, yeah, certainly, you know, these things wax and wane, and there are times when it seems like people are really into Bigfoot, and then there are times when, you know, people are kind of, you know, moved on to the next weird thing. And you're right, right now we seem to be in a real period where people are really fascinated by this stuff. And I think, again, you know, what's happened is the world has gotten even more connected since the rise of the internet. And so, you know, I mean, when I was a kid, it was like you could learn about foreign cultures, but you didn't, you know, unless you went there, you wouldn't really know, you know, what was going on or whatever. And, you know, you couldn't just immediately look up anything on your phone and figure out what the answer was. So there was still a little bit of, you know, the unknown out there. But with the rise of, you know, Google and social media, again, you know, our world seems to be collapsing once again, and maybe, you know, it's possible that that's driving now our desire for things that just really exist beyond the social web, you know, the Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster, which really escape our ability to kind of capture them and render them onto, you know, Twitter or Instagram.
I think what's really interesting is the way that a lot of these monsters seem to come out of the collision between different cultures. Like you write about the Jersey or the Leeds Devil, which could be ascribed to the collision of indigenous and colonizer cultures in early America. And I wonder if that element plays into the story today, too, because we're all so much more interconnected and there's so many more cultures and ideas colliding.
Right. Oh, yeah, I definitely think that is true. And certainly a lot of this stuff, you know, as you said, sort of comes about from people borrowing, or, you know, in some cases, sort of outright appropriation of, you know, indigenous cultures, or just that sort of collision that happens. So, you know, the Abominable Snowman is a more or less stable part of Tibetan folklore for, you know, generations, until suddenly you have a bunch of Anglo explorers who are trying to summit Mount Everest, and suddenly this thing kind of, almost like a virus, sort of jumps its host and then sort of is loose on the rest of the world. And all of a sudden, everybody is interested in the Abominable Snowman and the Yeti as a thing that is no longer just a part of, you know, a culture, but now like a real provable fact that if we send enough expeditions out to the Himalayas, we should be able to bring back, you know, evidence of. So yeah, so there is this kind of shifting of cultures that will often trigger or kind of reconfigure one of these stories into something in a new way.
So how do we see that play out in the States? That's where all the places you visited are, Mount Shasta, Darien, Georgia, etc. I mean, where do we see these collisions and appropriations happening here?
You know, it's interesting to me because, you know, once I sort of posited that this was something that you could trace through the idea of the frontier or the borderland, you start to see the way it plays out in white America's history of, you know, appropriating and confiscating native lands. So, you know, I mean, you mentioned before the idea that the Jersey Devil got its start when the New Jersey Pine Barrens were really on the edge of the colonial frontier and the colonial idea of what North America was. And then, you know, the United States starts pushing westward, and you find it again in a place like Alton, Illinois, where there is this this painting on a rock of something called the Piazza, which is a this giant bird that supposedly, you know, devours humans. And there are, you know, these really interesting and fascinating stories by the native cultures who are living in Illinois at the time that settlers and explorers kind of note down and then forget about. But then in 1977, so long after, you have this story out of Lawndale, Illinois, which is a couple hours from Alton, about a woman who is in the backyard with her six-year-old son, and these two giant birds swoop down from the sky and pick up her son and carry her son for about 20 or 30 feet before she's able to get them to drop him. And, you know, sort of unclear what happened. That's one of the ones where I really don't have a good explanation of what exactly that was. But, you know, cryptozoologists who are sort of looking for an explanation for this, they immediately go back to Native American Thunderbird stories and the story of the Piazza, and they start making these connections. So they start looking at Native American oral legend and folklore, not in terms of what it means for the culture that produced these stories, but in terms of, you know, is this empirical proof of something that I'm now trying to prove in the 20th century, you know, America. So that's, you know, again, it's sort of this very weird interplay where it's not always a case of direct appropriation, although often it is strongly appropriation, but there is a very peculiar attempt to kind of wed, you know, Native American folklore to modern, you know, cryptozoological obsessions, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, you touch on this a little in the context of the West and ranchers in the West in particular, with the right-wing militia movement. And there's this one quote you dug up from the right-wing militia member John Trockman, who in 1999 told a journalist, quote, "The people that were screwed over first in America were the Native Americans and blacks. Now it's our turn. So we've got to line up with them. They know more about it than we do." What is going on in that statement? And what does that self-identification of ranchers with the other have to do with the unidentified phenomena you talk about?
Right. So this happens all the time where the far right, you know, the sort of conspiratorial right wing, often takes a legitimate concern that the left or, you know, minorities, you know, blacks and Native Americans or, you know, other people in this culture have, and makes it suddenly about themselves in this very strange way. And again, we're watching this play out in real time where the right wing has said forever, oh, you know, the government is coming for our guns. They're going to, you know, disappear us in vans and take away our civil liberties. And that's literally what's happening in Portland. But the right is silent because it's not happening to them. It's happening to you know, left-wing protesters who are protesting police violence. So that's happening right now. But its antecedents go back decades. And there was a classified government project called Operation Garden Plot from the 1960s, which was basically how the military was going to respond to race riots or protests or, you know, stuff that was going to be coming from the left, from urban cultures, from black communities, from veterans, and it was about how to respond to these things militarily. And it was seized upon by right-wing conspiracy theorists and spun into a plot about how the government was going to come for them. And so again, this happens all the time. And that when that quote from Trockman that you mentioned is, you know, just sort of one example of the ways in which people are projecting legitimate fears that really don't apply to them onto themselves in a way that refracts and reflects a sort of strange dynamic in American conspiracy theories. And, you know, we're seeing it happen in real time, but its antecedents sort of run through the history of the West, I think.
Or it's like they're shifting some actual legitimate feeling they have of alienation or abandonment because of global economic forces beyond their control onto this other, like aliens or just the government, which I think comes out in the way people respond to cattle mutilation in particular, which you have a whole chapter on. So in the 1970s, small and part-time cattle ranchers were experiencing a lot of mysterious cases of cows being mutilated and were saying that it was either aliens or the government or some lurid conspiracy of both. And I would love for you to talk more about these cattle mutes, as they're called out west, because they've come back.
Right. So in the very late 60s and early 70s, you have a couple stories where ranchers come out and they find Their cattle have died in seemingly mysterious ways. You know, they'll say things like, you know, the blood was completely drained, sexual organs in the eyes were removed, but everything else was left intact. There were cuts that were too clean to be done by an animal that had to be done by some sort of, you know, surgical instrument or whatever. And this starts to take hold of kind of, you know, American consciousness sort of in the early 70s when, not coincidentally, there are a series of shocks in the cattle industry, basically due to sort of government interference during the Nixon administration. So people start sort of fixating on this idea that these cows are being killed in unnatural ways, and they start to blame the government. There are stories of, you know, these mysterious helicopters that are, you know, seen in the area, and it gets so bad that you know, ranchers are taking out their guns basically and shooting at, you know, local news choppers and things because they assume that they are the government come for their cows or whatever. And it starts to be a sort of government conspiracy theory, and then by the late 70s it has been reborn as this is actually the work of aliens. And yeah, as you say, I mean, when you dial down, I mean, first of all, these deaths turn out to be not all that unusual or uncommon, you know, and once researchers actually start looking into it, they are able to really prove pretty definitively that it's the work of scavengers. And one of the quotes that I came across that I think is really revelatory is that, you know, veterinarians aren't trained in forensic pathology. You know, they are trained to keep animals alive. So they're not actually very good. And it's not they're bad veterinarians. They're just not trained to look at the corpse of a cow and figure out how it got that way. You know, and neither are local sheriffs. It's not so much an uncanny mystery so much as a thing people aren't trained to do. And so they don't maybe necessarily have all the tools to do it accurately. But once you actually looked into it, you know, these cow mutilations aren't mutilations. They're just sort of, you know, scavenger work. But it does reflect maybe a mentality of somebody who sort of lives on the land and works on the land, but maybe doesn't know the land as well as they might, and thus sort of tends towards kind of conspiratorial or, you know, uncanny explanations for what may be actually happening. And again, like, you know, one of the things that was really noteworthy is the fact that the people singling out these cattle mutilations as significant were the small-time part-time ranchers who had less experience with cattle and cattle death, and not the sort of bigger, you know, intergenerational families who, you know, for better or for worse, were used to seeing this, knew what it was, and knew that it wasn't particularly all that worthy of note.
Well, and could survive, you know, one cow dying.
Exactly, yeah.
So why do you think cattle mutes came back? Because I had never seen a story of cattle mutilation until October. Suddenly there were a ton cattle mutes everywhere. NPR reports they're unexplained, not one drop of blood, and it's the same regions you're writing about. Like, to me, it seems like just further evidence of how the 70s never really left us, both in terms of the destruction of American industry and cattle mutes.
It went away not because somebody came along and, you know, conclusively proved what was happening and sort of dusted their hands and everybody said, okay, great. I mean, even though, as I said, you know, researchers were able to conclusively prove what was going on, that didn't take. That, you know, telling somebody the truth often doesn't do much to actually dissuade them of the belief. So the belief just sort of died off because people's attention were fixated elsewhere. But pretty much any time, you know, these things return, people will act as though, oh my gosh, you know, there's no explanation for this. You know, anything that looks unusual. What I find in the book, and I find both fascinating and a little disheartening, is anytime anybody is presented with anything unusual, there will be a segment of the population that jumps immediately to the wildest and most bizarre explanation. You know, there's a kind of reverse Occam's razor that happens of, you know, yeah, so the, you know, these cattle died in Oregon and they, you know, people didn't immediately know how and why they died. So rather than kind of methodically work through all the possibilities from most likely to least likely, they, you know, ran to the press and they said something crazy is happening. And, you know, I mean, it's hard not to want to, you know, delve into that story. It's hard not to want to, you know, jump on that bandwagon. So, you know, that's probably going to keep happening. They're probably still going to be, you know, we'll see that story again in a couple of years, I'm sure.
So if proving that it was not aliens that killed your cow doesn't work, and if a lot of these stories keep resurfacing over the decades or the centuries, what place do you think conspiracy theories and cryptids and these notions of the unidentified have in our society? And is it benign or is it worrying? And is there any moral dimension here?
Right. I mean, where it ultimately came down is I feel like there's kind of two strands that are interwoven often, but, you know, maybe can sometimes be teased apart. I think there is certainly a kind of benign desire for wonder and magic in the world. And certainly as a result of, or, you know, reaction to modernization and industrialization, this desire for something that's still out there unexplained, that seems pretty harmless to me. I mean, you know, there are a lot of ways in which it can go wrong. You know, and I think, you know, Ancient Aliens, with its kind of suggestion that, you know, maybe the Egyptians didn't build the pyramids, that it was built by, you know, aliens. I mean, there's kind of low-key bigotry and chauvinism there that runs through those kind of narratives about, you know, we don't believe that these non-Western cultures were capable of doing the things that they very obviously did. But, you know, setting that aside, I think, you know, kind of love of the Loch Ness Monster or whatever, I mean, that seems pretty benign and harmless. And I encourage it. And I, you know, I mean, I went out, you know, cryptid hunting and I had a lot of fun. I think it's cool. But the flip side of that, I think, is the kind of conspiratorial element. And I think that comes from a desire to reconcile the order and the chaos of the world around you that you perceive that is terrifying to you, and trying to find a mechanism or an explanation that, you know, puts some kind of order, even if it's malevolent, right? You know, so it's easier to think that the Illuminati pull the strings behind the scenes than it is for some people to admit that the world is just random chaos. And I think that's when things start to get a little dangerous, because that's, you know, often where you sort of open yourself up for, you know, anything from sort of anti-Semitism to the deep conspiratorial attitude that that can really destabilize, you know, an individual and also a community. So I think it's a balance of looking for that wonder and that magic and being open to that possibility without backing yourself into a corner where you're coming up with increasingly paranoid and problematic ways of describing the world around you. And, you know, it's a balancing act.
We have links in the show notes to Colin Dickey's new book, The Unidentified: Mythical Monsters, Alien Encounters, and Our Obsession with the Unexplained, along with a number of links to some fun phenomena, including my favorites, those cattle mutes. We'll be back next week. Till then, take care and stay sharp.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.